You're listening to Under Surveillance, WLEW's look at the intersection of popular culture, politics, and sociology. My name is Kevin Fulham, and I'll be joined every second and fourth Wednesday mornings by a series of guests as we examine everything from the depiction of American government in film and television to notable themes in various genres of cinema. For more information or to access previous shows and related essays, head to www.undersurveillance.org. That's www.undersurveillance.org. Today on Under Surveillance, an examination of the critically acclaimed period drama Mad Men, which focuses on the lives of advertising executives in 1960s America. Mad Men creator Matt Weiner uses the show as a vehicle for commentary on everything from changing social mores and gender roles to the illusion of personal identity and domestic tranquility. Returning as my guest is pop culture critic Leonard Pierce, who currently contributes to the Onion's AV Club, and whose writing can be found at ludicid.com. Mad Men on Under Surveillance, up next. Good morning and welcome to another edition of Under Surveillance on WLEW. My name is Kevin Fulham, and today on the show we'll be examining the critically acclaimed television period drama Mad Men, which is about to begin its third season on AMC. Mad Men focuses on the professional and personal lives of the Manhattan-based Sterling Cooper Advertising Agency, set against the backdrop of early 1960s, and as such is a vehicle for commentary on everything from gender roles in the workplace to the illusion of personal identity, the latter of which is exemplified by the primary character of the show, ad executive Don Draper. Returning as my guest is pop culture critic Leonard Pierce, who's written about film and music for numerous national publications, and he also currently contributes to The Onion's AV Club. Welcome back to the show, Leonard.
Thanks, Kevin. It's good to be back.
Leonard, to begin, what makes the 1960s an especially pertinent time period for the setting of Mad Men?
Well, the 1960s were obviously a time of great flux for society in general, and advertising being a profession which is very keenly attuned to social trends and to the way that social behavior is changing and growing, it's always been very, very attuned to that. So if you want to talk about the time at which advertising was perhaps the most relevant to American society, you want to talk about the 1950s and the 1960s. And in particular, you want to talk about that time because that's also the time in which advertising agencies became huge. Advertising went from being sort of a niche occupation to being, you know, an extremely dominant kind of business on its own, that the advertising men of that era, as you see very frequently in Mad Men, would be in charge of many aspects of the production of the product. They wouldn't just do what they had done in previous generations of ad men, which is go to a particular product and say, well, here's how we'd like to see this product sold. They would actually be in charge of product development, of design. You know, they would take charge of all different aspects of the way a company made and marketed its products. And, you know, that was fairly unprecedented at the time. And you were seeing advertising agencies of the sort that Sterling Cooper, the agency in Mad Men, it's a fictional agency, but it was patterned after some of the big companies like Young and Rubicam. They were becoming huge entities on their own rather than simply small businesses that would hustle for the clients that they were all looking to get. And that was what was happening in the late 50s and early 60s. So, you know, you combine those two things, the fact that they were getting very into social change and that the society that they were attempting to sell products to was in flux, and the fact that they were flush with money and power that they had never had before. It's a very rich environment to set a show like that in. And you also don't want to forget what's become, sort of ironically, one of the biggest selling points of Mad Men, which is its extremely stylish show in what is sort of an unusual but not unexpected development for a show that's all about advertising and marketing. It's become a show that a lot of people are building advertising and marketing around. You know, they have you have a lot of tie-in products, and you have can't remember who it is. It's one of the big clothing companies has their own Mad Men line of clothes that are sort of 50s, 60s retro throwback styles. And you know, everybody has been very struck by the visual style of the show, and that's because it's set in this era that a lot of people consider, you know, a period of very high style in American fashion and culture, so that also contributes. You know, if you were setting the show in the 70s or the 30s, it might not have been possible to do that. But setting it in the, you know, late 50s, early 60s, you get to show this very stylish period of American history.
But I think also, too, you have, you know, at the beginning of the show, the very first season, they talk about the birth of the relationship between the advertising industry and also politics. Because, you know, one of the subplots running through the first season is that I believe it's the Nixon people who are interested in having Sterling Cooper run their campaign, right?
Right. You see that actually throughout the first and the second season. You also have a minor character in the second season. I can't remember his name, but he works for one of the big PR firms, and he mentions that his firm was contracted by the Kennedy administration to handle the Bay of Pigs invasion, and that turned into a political disaster for them, so they took a big hit on that. And, you know, that was a period in which that sort of thing was being handed to traditional marketing and advertising firms, and you don't see that anymore. It's really the same people, but now it's handed to very specific public relations and lobbying groups, but they're really the same people, you know, as they were back then. They're just much more specialized field. You know, you wouldn't see you know, the Obama administration hiring a mainstream advertising agency to handle any kind of political PR. They would farm it out to, you know, these very specialized firms. But those firms exist today because of people who were in that market in the 60s. So it's very interesting the way they weave that political narrative in there, because a lot of people don't realize how closely tied to the political scene advertising agencies were back then, and public relations agencies were. And, you know, you also see somewhat of a reflection of that in the fact that one of the major themes in the show is how the advertisers relate to youth culture and how they are affected by it and how they sort of try and grasp the zeitgeist of the time. And the liberal writer Thomas Frank, his first book was called The Conquest of Cool, and it was about how this very generation of ad men in the 50s and 60s didn't just sort of harness and exploit youth culture, but helped to create it and guide it. So it wasn't even really a case of their co-opting it and turning it phony, that it was sort of almost phony to begin with, that, you know, they guided youth culture to such a degree from the very beginning that it was infiltrated by advertising almost from its inception. You know, I think one of the strengths of Mad Men as a narrative is that it very skillfully portrays the way that these guys were so intimately connected with youth culture and political culture at the time.
Well, there's certainly the resistance, I think. You see in season two that there's a big push coming from Duck Phillips, who is the head of the accounts at Sterling Cooper. He's trying to push to have young folks involved in the creative process. And Don Draper, who is the head of the creative department at Sterling Cooper, is very resistant to the idea. You know, young people, they don't know anything. And they basically wind up taking these two guys on. One of them seems to come right out of the hippie beatnik mold in terms of the lingo.
Yeah, one of his friends in college wrote the Port Huron statement, you know, and we see him reading from it in the scene, you know, about how it really speaks to his generation.
Yeah, and I think also, too, you have a couple of scenes between Don Draper, who exemplifies corporate America at the time, and then also a bunch of kind of beatnik guys who are friends of his mistress at the time, this woman named Midge, who lives in the village in New York City. And they're hanging out at a nightclub. And you see that confrontation between the two generations in terms of, you know, them looking at him as the embodiment of what's wrong with America in terms of how the marketing industry creates want and creates desire. And he fires back at them that they're not really accomplishing anything in terms of the way of social change by lying around and getting high all the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I actually thought those scenes were very weak. I think the show is often at its weakest when it shows the people who are at odds with Don Draper. I think the show is sympathetic enough with his character that it often doesn't succeed when it shows him alternatives to his lifestyle. And, you know, I thought probably the weakest point of the first season was those hippies, you know, those sort of proto-beatnik types, because they were so cartoonish. They were so, you know, like, they were such easy targets for Don Draper, you know. I mean, they were so one-dimensional that he was able to dismantle them and show them to be total phonies. And I think that that's a poor way to set up a villain or an oppositional character in a TV show, because you want them to be worthy adversaries for your main character. And I thought they were you know, those beatniks were so sort of cartoonishly drawn that they weren't very effective. I much preferred in season two when they set up as his nemesis, the TV comedian.
Jimmy Barrett.
Yeah, Jimmy Barrett, who, you know, of course, Don starts an affair with Jimmy Barrett's wife, and that affair brings up a lot of issues he has in his life. And Jimmy is portrayed as this really creepy, unlikable character. You know, he's almost, like, physically repulsive. And, you know, he's constantly hitting on women, and he can't keep his mouth shut. He's always insulting people. And he's just really portrayed as this unpleasant character. And yet he's the one who really zeroes in on Don's weaknesses and calls him out and, you know, tells him what kind of person he thinks he is. And I think that's a much more effective oppositional scene than the beatniks of season one because, you know, here you have this character who really is very unlikable and yet is quite a powerful opponent for Don because he's not easily fooled. He's not this one-dimensional character who Don can easily just take him apart, you know. And I sort of wish that, you know, those beatniks had been shown to be a little bit more two-dimensional or three-dimensional because Midge especially is shown to be a somewhat complex character. And Don himself, you know, has these elements of the counterculture to him. He clearly is happy being the man in the gray flannel suit, you know, the wealthy, successful, mainstream Madison Avenue guy. But you constantly see him sort of searching for a little more. You know, he buys books of poetry and he goes to see foreign films. And, you know, he obviously either has this desire to add a sort of avant-garde intellectual quality to his life or at least to understand that so he can use it in his profession. And yet, you know, it's a scene that he can never really be part of, and I think that's somewhat of a frustration to him. And so, I found that scene with the beatniks to be a little false because, you know, there's so much more complexity in that relationship than those scenes imply.
My name is Kevin Fulham, and you're listening to Under Surveillance on WLEW. And my guest today is pop culture critic Leonard Pierce, and we're talking all about the critically acclaimed television period drama Mad Men, which is about to begin its third season in a couple of weeks. And Mad Men focuses on the Sterling Cooper Advertising Agency, and it's set in 1960s-era Manhattan. And it's a vehicle for commentary on all sorts of social issues, gender roles in the workplace. It's something that we're going to get to in a little bit. You talked about Don basically searching for something more in terms of his life, and illusion is one of the core themes of the show. Certainly you have Don Draper and the other executives creating that sense of illusion with regards to the products that they're hawking in terms of coming up with campaigns to create whatever atmosphere they're trying to generate. You also, though, have a guy who's basically invented his entire identity, or stolen his identity, I guess, from someone else. It's all about living the life of the person you want to be. And the line also seems to be a tagline for the American dream. You know, Don is kind of like the American dream, that, you know, it doesn't matter what your background is, you can just create a new life, a new identity for yourself in the United States.
Well, you've certainly hit upon probably the major theme of the show. You know, they, especially in the second season, they hammer that home time and time again. You know, not only the live the life of the person you want to be, but Jimmy Barrett's wife at one point explaining how she came to be his manager as well as his wife says, make up a job and then become the person who does it, to explain, you know, how she came to find her level of success. And so the show is, you know, constantly pushing that idea that these are people who have self-invented themselves, you know, that they have created an identity that they want to fulfill, and they've thrown themselves into it with abandon, you know. But one of the skillful things about the show, I believe, is that it shows that it's not ever possible to do that completely. Don can never totally escape the person that he was. You know, there are elements of his childhood that crop up again and again to sort of dire consequences. Sometimes when he's reminded of the person he was, it's to good effect. You know, we see him in the second season visiting the wife of the man whose identity he assumed, and she acts as somewhat of a almost a life coach for him, you know, telling him what he needs to do to become at ease with himself and to repair the wreck he's made of his life. But we also see in season one where he has a long-lost brother who comes to visit him, and he's so sort of repulsed at the reminder of who he was that he refuses to have anything to do with this brother who eventually kills himself. So Don can never completely escape the person that he was, and he can never really resist the temptations that go along with that. Likewise, Peggy Olson, she, in the first season, has a child out of wedlock, and Don is the one who advises her to sort of pretend that it never happened, to forcefully drive from her mind the idea that it ever happened, because it'll get in the way of her becoming the person she wants to be. And, of course, she does that with a sort of ruthlessness that's a little terrifying, but she can't really escape it. You know, there are always elements in her life that remind her of what happened, not only the fact that she works with Pete Campbell, who's the guy that impregnated her, but also her sister is raising the child as if it was her own, and her sister greatly resents her and, you know, the fact that she left her to take care of this child. There's a character in the second season played by Colin Hanks, who does a very good job, I believe, who plays the local priest who finds out about the child and really kind of pressures Peggy to take responsibility for it. So, you know, the complexity of that idea, the duality of both wanting to become the person you want to be and knowing that you can never fully escape the person that you were, and the consequences of that, is one of the best features of the show. I think it's very powerfully portrayed.
The whole relationship between that priest and Peggy I thought was very interesting, because when they first meet, it seems that on some level there's a romantic attraction there, that the priest is interested in Peggy. And the interest fades when he finds out through Peggy's sister that she actually had a kid out of wedlock and basically abandoned the child. But he continually pressures her. He doesn't actually reveal what he knows. He doesn't want to break that seal of confession. But he continually pressures her to basically come clean with her quote-unquote sin. It almost seems that he's trying to exert some sort of, or have power over her, or leverage over her.
Yeah, it's an interesting balance between, you know, what I feel like is genuine spiritual concern and a sort of a power play, you know, for having a, you know, now he's got a sort of element with which to control her. And, you know, of course, her reaction is very similar, you know, her constantly ducking the issue and pretending not to know what he's talking about and, you know, avoiding that. You know, it's not only her way of retaining power in that relationship and, you know, just sort of trying to stonewall him, but it's also probably a genuine psychological defense. So the way that he reacts to her and the way that she reacts to him is a very complex but very well illustrated, I think.
There's another scene where between Don Draper and Bobby Barrett, who's Jimmy Barrett's wife, we're just talking about before, where Don is in bed with her for the, you know, umpteenth time, and she starts talking about his past and the fact that there are other women out there in the media industry who are talking about him and about how he's this kind of playboy-type lover. And that upsets him greatly, to the point at which he basically storms out of the room. And he doesn't want to be reminded of that past, doesn't want to have people talking about him or see himself in that kind of light.
Yeah, well, it's both frustrating and rewarding the way the show makes it clear that Don Draper does not like being called out for who Don Draper is. You know, he's very willing to judge other people on behaviors that he himself shows all the time. You know, when he hears Bobby Barrett talk about the fact that he's sort of perceived as this upper-class gigolo, basically, by a certain type of Manhattan woman, it infuriates him. And yet he doesn't mind the fact that Bobby Barrett sleeps around. You know, that doesn't bother him at all. But the idea that people perceive him the way that he perceives her drives him crazy. You know, it just, you know, he can't tolerate it. And similarly, in what I feel was sort of another misstep in season two, but thankfully it didn't last very long, was Don goes to California to do some research into some aeronautical clients, you know, in the aerospace industry. And while he's there, he meets up with these sort of decadent, very wealthy, idle Europeans, and they repulse him, you know, and it's really hard to figure out why, because they sort of have the life that he's perceived for himself all along. You know, they don't have to work, they're very wealthy, you know, they're very intelligent and clever, and, you know, they have their little sexual picadillos, but, you know, that doesn't bother him when he's sleeping with one of the teenage girls in their company. You know, he sleeps with one of the members of this Eurotrash clique's daughter, and, you know, he judges them for their behavior, which he finds to be fairly extreme, and yet it's really nothing that he hasn't done himself many times. So we find that Don is very sensitive to any portrayal of himself as being the way he really is, and that's why he reacts so badly when Jimmy Barrett calls him out on his crimes, because, you know, he's like, well, how could that scummy creep, you know, possibly know me? And yet the audience knows that Jimmy Barrett has completely pegged Don for who he is, and that's what upsets him so much.
You're listening to Under Surveillance on WLEW, and my name is Kevin Fulham, and I'm joined today by pop culture critic Leonard Pierce, who's written about film and music for numerous national publications. He also contributes to The Onion's AV Club, and we're talking all about the critically acclaimed television drama Mad Men, and talking about how Don basically can't take the reflection of himself fired right back at him. I think that kind of leads us into another theme of the show in terms of, you know, what's wrong with me? What's wrong with Don that he can't remain faithful to his wife, Betty? And Betty is this gorgeous woman. She was a former model. They seem on the outside to exemplify the ideal American family. You know, they've got, you know, two young kids. They've got this great house out in the suburbs with the yard and the dog. And she's terminally unhappy. You know, what's wrong with her that she's very unhappy with the routines of motherhood? What's wrong with her that she can't maintain Don's interest? She can't keep her husband interested. Why do you think that Don married a woman like Betty? You know, you see Don throughout certainly the first season. He's very attracted to Midge, also Rachel Menken, who is another woman that he meets that's very much a strong, powerful woman. She's an executive for a department store. Very unlike, it seems, the kind of woman that he married. And even Bobby Barrett, another very strong, aggressive, independent woman. Why do you see that disconnect there?
Well, you know, I would also mention Dick Whitman's wife, you know, who he's never portrayed as having a romantic relationship with, but he definitely seems to get along with her a lot better than he does with his own wife.
And, oh, Don Draper's wife, you mean? The original Don Draper.
Right, I'm sorry, yes, Don Draper's wife. And, you know, she's a very intellectual woman. She lives alone. She's a single woman who has gotten rid of the stigma of single women that existed at the time. She's very comfortable with herself, you know. Don gets along with her a lot better than he gets along with his wife. The guy who created Mad Men, Matt Weiner, he came from, he's been in television for quite a while, but he's best known for being a writer on The Sopranos. And those two shows deal with one of my favorite issues in fiction, which is the idea that you can get what you want and still not be happy. And, you know, The Sopranos was all about that. You know, you had this guy who, through a combination of canniness and brutality, got almost everything he could have dreamed of, and yet he still wasn't happy because he was bothered by his conscience and his family wasn't happy with the way that they got to where they were. And in Mad Men, you have a very similar theme. You have a guy who's gotten just about everything he wanted, and yet he's still not happy. You know, he's not happy with the way things turned out. He got what he wanted, and it turned out it wasn't enough, or it wasn't the right thing. And his relationship with Betty is very tragic, because he obviously, as you say, wants a very different kind of woman than the one that he married, and yet he feels a tremendous amount of guilt whenever he steps out of the bounds of marriage. You know, he's always riddled with guilt for, you know, his various affairs, and I think he sort of married her because she's the sort of woman that you're expected to marry when you're a man in his position. The traditional, very successful executive, you know, the big shot in the gray flannel suit, doesn't marry a, you know, powerful, independent, intellectual woman. He marries a trophy wife. You know, he marries a pretty young thing who he can show off at parties and who's going to stay at home and take care of the kids. And that is what Don was expected to do, but it's not what he wanted to do. And I think that's one of the reasons why he's constantly stepping outside of the boundaries of marriage, not just with anyone. You know, we don't see him going and, you know, picking up hookers or anything. We see him stepping outside of marriage to be with women who are challenging to him. And I don't think that Betty is. And Betty, for her side, you know, I think one of the huge tragedies there is that she's a woman who's living in a society not yet ready to deal with her particular problems. And I think that Betty is portrayed as borderline mentally ill. You know, there are a number of points at which she just expresses this nameless rage that's almost terrifying, you know, and just does these kind of unexpected, scary things. You never would be surprised if she, you know, hurt someone or hurt herself. You know, she's portrayed as certainly depressive and almost borderline crazy.
There's a scene in season one where she takes a rifle out and starts shooting pigeons, right?
Right, yeah. She shoots her neighbor's birds. And, you know, there's a scene in season two where she's frustrated by planning this party for some of Don's coworkers, and she just picks up one of her dining room chairs and smashes it to pieces, you know, for no particular reason other than that she's frustrated and she has no outlet for that frustration. Towards the end of season two, when she finds out that she's pregnant again, she deliberately tries to induce an abortion by going out and riding her horse in a really vigorous way, which she's been advised by her doctor not to do. And, you know, she's clearly a woman who has a lot of mental problems, but she lives in a society where there's a very big stigma against that still. And, you know, it would not only ruin her husband and her peers' perception of her as the perfect wife to do anything about it, but it would ruin her own self-image, you know. So he's married to a woman who can't be the kind of woman he wants, and she's married to a man who ignores the fact that she's got problems of her own, and, you know, that's the inherent tragedy of their marriage.
And you see her just desperate for attention during the whole show. There's this very creepy sequence, a couple of different sequences, with a neighborhood boy named Glenn.
By Matt Weiner's own son, by the
way. Oh, really? Okay. Yeah, he's around 10, 11, 12 years old, and he is the son of a divorced mother who lives nearby. And in the first season, she's babysitting, and he wants a lock of her hair because he thinks that she's so beautiful. But then there's a sequence in season two where she discovers that Glenn ran away from home and has actually been camped out in their backyard for several days. And she brings him in and lets him take a shower and gets him clean clothes and feeds him. And they're sitting on the couch, and he puts his hand in her hand. He's almost, I guess, obsessed with this woman. And rather than saying, well, you know, this is very unacceptable behavior, she encourages it the entire time.
So it's a very creepy scene. The character of Glenn and the way he behaves towards her is extremely creepy, but very effective, I think, because it definitely shows how starved for the attention of anyone that she is, you know, for anybody to pay attention to her and, you know, express any interest in her life. And that's not the only time we see that. She has this very powerful self-destructive streak that often expresses itself in these needs for attention that she doesn't care what kind of attention it is, you know. In season two, she sort of encourages for a while the attentions of this guy who belongs to the writing club that she belongs to. You know, she encourages his flirtations for a while until it gets a little too serious, and then she sort of hooks him up with another woman at the club with disastrous results. And we also see her car breaks down, and she comes very close to seducing the mechanic who comes out to fix it just to see what it was like, because she ran into a friend of hers earlier in the evening who had become a call girl, and she became obsessed with that idea of sex with strangers. And she also, later in the season, after she finds out that she's pregnant, she hooks up with a total stranger at a hotel and has sex with him. And, you know, there's a very dangerous quality to it, because she doesn't really seem to care who she's getting involved with, because she's so desperate to break out of her isolation that she's getting involved with people who she knows nothing about, who could hurt her, you know. And through it all, she maintains this sort of creepy superiority. You know, one of the most telling details, you know, that just really gives the whole scene in the hotel where she hooks up with this total stranger this chill of, you know, like almost grotesqueness, is that right before they go into his room to have sex with this total stranger, she says, "I'm married." You know, as if to say, well, I am above this sort of thing. You may be used to doing this sort of thing, but I am not. You know, I am a married woman, and I just want, you know, as if she just has to make it known that she would not do this sort of thing, that she's better than him, you know. And we see little elements of that come out all the time in her self-destructive behavior, you know, that she's attempting to maintain control while still betraying these desires that she has. When she has the young man at the writing club hook up with her friend, it's something that she clearly was planning to do, and yet when the woman tells her that she had an affair with this young man, Betty really just is repulsed by it. She condemns her in these very strong terms, you know. And when she and Jimmy Barrett are alone in a club, and Jimmy reveals to her that his wife has been sleeping with Don, Betty takes it out on him. He takes it out on Jimmy Barrett instead of on her husband. And she drops this very anti-Semitic line at Jimmy, you know, as if it's his fault that her wife, that her husband is cheating on her. And it's a very skillful portrayal. I think she was nominated for an Emmy this year. And that actress, January Jones, I believe is her name, she very skillfully portrays that sort of both desperateness and superiority. You know, she both desperately needs to get out of the situation she's in, and yet she can't betray the fact that anything isn't perfect. You know, she still has to maintain this image of herself as the perfect wife and the perfect person.
Yeah, you see that with both Don and Betty, that it's fine to do whatever they like as far as the illusion is not shattered. Once you pierce that illusion, that's when the problems begin.
One of the most interesting things I wanted to mention real quick is that it's actually considered shocking and borderline unacceptable when Roger Sterling decides to marry his young mistress, who previously had been Don's secretary. That's considered this very shocking and unacceptable thing. And that's really funny because when he's carrying on affairs with people constantly, I mean, he's portrayed as like the most roguish person as Sterling Cooper. He's got, you know, he's constantly having affairs with call girls, with models, with young girls in the office, with his secretary. I mean, he's constantly dogging his wife. And nobody says anything about it. And yet when he decides to actually marry one of his affairs, everybody's shocked by that. You know, it's a breach of protocol. It's perfectly okay to have lots of affairs, but it's not okay to take them seriously enough that you'd break up your marriage over it.
My name is Kevin Fulham, and you're listening to Under Surveillance on WLUW. And my guest today is pop culture critic Leonard Pierce. And we're talking all about the critically acclaimed television drama Mad Men. And Mad Men focuses on the professional and personal lives of the Manhattan-based Sterling Cooper Advertising Agency. And it's set against the backdrop of the early 1960s. And just talking about the fact that so many of the characters on the show have affairs, especially Roger Sterling. In terms of workplace behavior and the general environment that these people inhabit, it's amazing to see when you're looking at it through the lens of 2009 America. Not only in terms of gender roles, but also, I mean, these people are nonstop drinkers. Everyone's office has a bar, and, you know, they start right when they get in the office in the morning, and it continues all day long. When did that sort of era die out? Was the 60s kind of the end of that sort of corporate type of environment, or what?
Well, yeah, it depends on who you ask. The show sometimes, it definitely trades in irony a lot when it shows you these things. Like, it will very often tip its hand in sort of telegraphing these little jokes about how little people knew back then. There's a scene in season one where we see a mother yelling at her child for playing with a plastic dry cleaning bag, but it's not because she's afraid the kid will suffocate. It's because she's afraid that he'll get her dry cleaning dirty, you know. And so, and of course, we often see the kids like rolling around and jumping over the seats in the car while it's in motion. None of them are wearing seat belts, you know. And people smoke constantly, and you know, even the doctors smoke in their offices. You know, everybody's smoking all the time.
Yeah, the pregnant women are smoking and drinking as well too.
Yeah, absolutely, and. Yeah, as you say, people are just drinking nonstop. And, you know, I've actually read a number of interviews with people who were in advertising at the time, and there seems to be a fairly even split. And not, you know, coming from that world, I can't really say, you know, who's right, but it seems like about half of them say, well, yeah, Mad Men exaggerated things a bit. I mean, we used to smoke and drink, but we weren't drunk all the time. And, you know, there was sexual harassment, but it wasn't like we were chasing. I mean, there are scenes in Mad Men where they chase women around the office and pull their skirts down, you know. And, you know, well, we didn't do things like that. That was over the top. And then, you know, half of them seem to say, well, yeah, that's exactly what it was like. We drank constantly. We smoked all the time in the office. We treated women like trash, you know. And it's sort of hard to say who's right. I do know that my mom was in the business world at that time. She was of the sort of the first generation where women were becoming professionals, and she definitely says that she ran into a lot of situations of the sort that were portrayed in Mad Men, you know, just the sort of, you know, like the women would have to wait until the men had eaten before they could eat, you know, and, you know, the idea that the women were second-class citizens, and that it was nearly impossible for them to break into any kind of professional role, I have very little doubt that that was really the case.
There's a scene near the end of season two where Freddie Rumson's one of the account executives at Sterling Cooper, and he's just completely drunk right before this big meeting with one of their clients, and he urinates all over himself and then passes out. And, you know, Matt Weiner in the commentary has said that that was actually taken from real stories of people who had seen that happen.
Well, I mean, you know, definitely there are people today who will tell you that in advertising, if you need to get a client out into a restaurant and feed him a four martini lunch in order to get the deal done, that's what's going to happen. So, you know, I think that sort of lifestyle certainly is no longer prevalent. I would guess it started going out in the 70s when things like workplace safety rules came into effect and when absolute links were made between smoking and cancer and workplaces became smoke-free. I think that sort of began to be the death of that lifestyle in general. But I have seen offices many times just in the last few years where people, where executives still keep bars in their office. And any time that an executive in any field is entertaining a client whose business they need, they're still going to show them a good time. You know, in any city, there are always tons and tons of strip clubs downtown. And that's not because, you know, they're catering to the SUV crowd. You know, those are catering to business people who work downtown and who want to take their clients to those strip clubs. So, you know, I think that certainly the sort of wild freebooting, you know, drink all day and party all night lifestyle that we see in Sterling Cooper is a thing of the past, but we still see residuals of it everywhere. I mean, especially in fields like marketing and advertising and design, you know, and in any field where you have to show your clients a good time to get their business, you're going to see that until the end of time.
You're mentioning also, you know, the kids playing with the plastic bags, the playing around in the back seat without any seatbelts. There's also this great scene near the end of season two where they show the Draper family going to a park and having a picnic. And when it comes time to go and pack up, Don takes his beer can and tosses it into the field. They pick up their towel, let all the trash scatter, and then take off. And the camera just lingers on that for you know, about 10 seconds or so. And it's just a great scene in terms of talking about what the public attitude was regarding even things like litter and trash in public places back then.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, another scene that I find both telling and amusing is how the Draper's daughter, Sally, at parties, it's her job to fix drinks for the guests. We frequently will see Dawn telling her how to mix a particular drink, and she'll come in, you know, with a set of glasses and serve everyone. And she's, what, seven years old, you know? And nobody would do that today, you know? It's just unthinkable that people would put their children to work preparing cocktails for them, you know? And there's even a scene where she goes with Dawn when he has to work on a weekend and hangs around the office and sort of adopts the behaviors of the adults, and she sneaks a little bit of alcohol, you know, because everyone is drinking at the office. And the children, when we see groups of the neighborhood children playing together, their language is very deliberately adoptive of their parents. You know, they talk to each other like adults, you know, like miniature adults, and it's definitely meant to be both funny and sort of creepy. I really enjoy the way that the show is able to do that. It's able to say, look, you know, these people are influencing their children in ways that they're very blind to, and in ways that 40 years on we cannot even imagine taking place.
One of the things that we haven't addressed is the subject of race relations. And, you know, you mentioned Sally going to the office. She winds up wandering into the office of a writer named Paul. And Paul at that time has a black girlfriend, and whose picture he keeps on the desk. And she sees the picture, and she asks, you know, why do you have a picture of your maid up on your desk? Mm-hmm. And also, you know, you see that both the Drapers and also Betty's parents have black servants. One of the things that I was a little surprised about is the fact that they didn't really explore that too much, the whole fact that he had an executive for Sterling Cooper who had a black girlfriend who, I mean, you would think it would be extremely taboo, certainly at that time period, even in a place like New York City.
Well, you know, it didn't strike me as that particularly false, because Paul's image is that of this very kind of wild bohemian. You know, he's a he's a self-styled writer. He's a, you know, sort of a quasi-beatnik himself. He wants to be a great novelist, and he deliberately chooses to live in New Jersey instead of New York because he thinks all the people in Greenwich Village are phonies. You know, he's just sort of the prototypical hipster of the day. And Joan Holloway, the office manager on the show, who was once his girlfriend, calls him out on it and says, "Oh, I see you've acquired the new trendy thing, which is a black girlfriend." And it was unusual at the time, but I think it would have been more forgiving in the atmosphere of Sterling Cooper, because you have to keep in mind a lot of the, you know, Dara mentions this a few times, that, you know, advertising is a field that is infested back then and today with people who are bohemian, you know, that are sort of artistic people, that are artists and writers and things like that. It's one of the few fields in which creative people can make a lot of money. And so, you know, I think there would have been a little bit more tolerance of something like that, you know. Like, if Paul had been a banker, you know, he probably would not have been able to get away with dating a black girl at the, you know, at that time. But, you know, if he's working in advertising and he's got this reputation as sort of the bohemian hipster type, it might not just not only be forgiven, but almost expected. You know, Joan basically accuses him of doing it just to inflate his own image. Like, look at what a tolerant person I am, I'm dating a black girl. At one point in the series, he actually travels to the South to take place in some civil rights rallies with his girlfriend. And I think that was actually managed pretty well, because you have to keep in mind that was happening all the time back then. You know, a lot of the people who were taking part in these Southern civil rights rallies were actually white civil rights workers from the North. But it also doesn't portray Paul as doing it for entirely decent purposes. He tries to weasel out of it, and he only ends up going because he was supposed to take this trip to California that gets canceled. And, you know, when we see him riding the bus with these, you know, with these black protesters, he's pontificating about Karl Marx and how, you know, advertising is going to help save, you know, the world, and it's going to be a major factor in civil rights and everything.
Advertising knows no color, I think, is the, right, the line that he uses.
Yeah, which, you know, of course, has proven to be false, you know, and by later events. But, you know, he's shown as a sort of blowhard in that regard, and, you know, he's sort of lecturing the people he's on the bus with. And so I thought it was actually fairly well handled, but it is very weird, you know, especially insofar as, of course, the show is a period piece, but we're so used to seeing television shows as being very multicultural that it's very jarring to see a show that looks so much like TV really looked back then. You know, I mean, back then you could turn on a TV and you would not see any black people at all, or if you did, they were entertainers or servants. And that's exactly what happens on Mad Men. You turn on Mad Men and all you're going to see, I mean, I think the only black characters with speaking roles other than Paul's girlfriend are the elevator operator and Don Draper's maid. And that's really the way television was back then. So,
well, one of the things that we hadn't yet discussed, the character of Joan Holloway, you mentioned just a few moments ago, who's the office manager at Sterling Cooper. So she's in charge of the other secretaries there on the floor. And she also, for a long time, was carrying on an affair with Roger Sterling, the vice president of the company. And very much the femme fatale of the office. You know, she's very voluptuous. She attracts attention wherever she goes. And there's also this kind of quiet desperation that surrounds her character.
Well, I really like Joan, you know, and yet I have to say I hate her at the same time. And I think that's one of the show's successes, is that there's no one on the show who's really likable. You know, I mean, everyone on the show has some major flaws. You know, of course, Don Draper is deeply flawed. His wife is, she seems definitely to be racist, and she's certainly, like, mentally unbalanced, you know, and Paul, who seems to be a nice guy, is also something of a phony and a pseudo-intellectual poser. The younger copywriters tend to be kind of callow jerks, and Roger Sterling is a, you know, this womanizing creep who destroys his family over a 20-year-old secretary, and Bertram Cooper is sort of this old crank, you know, this sort of reclusive old coot, you know, and sort of hides out in his office at the top of the tower, and you know, he seems gregarious enough, but he's also very eccentric and weird. And almost everyone on the show is unlikable in some way, and yet, you know, they're never completely completely irredeemable, you know, and Joan is a perfect example of that. Joan is very likable in that she's incredibly canny and intelligent. She's very adept. She's very good at what she does. She has hidden talents. You know, we discover that she's actually a very astute judge of people, and then when she gets that television reading job, she's quite good at it. Not only is good at reading the scripts, but she even finds business opportunities for the clients. You know, she goes above and beyond the call of what the job requires. And yet, you know, she's also very manipulative. She's very, you know, for lack of a better word, she's very bitchy. She doesn't like her authority challenged. She is very contemptuous of people below her. She's very concerned with keeping people in her place. One of the creepy elements of when she meets Paul's black girlfriend is that she's really trying to degrade Paul and show him as, you know, this kind of phony, and yet she doesn't care that she's hurting the girl's feelings to the point of being, you know, almost nakedly racist to her, you know, saying that, oh, she, you know, maybe someday you'll be lucky enough to be a customer at the grocery store you work at, you know, and just she's got these unlikable qualities. And yet, in the end, you sort of end up rooting for her because you know there's so much more to her. And I think that's a sign of a very skilled writer. You know, it takes characters like that, and I would mention as another one is Pete Campbell, you know, who's very supercilious, proper, kind of creep, you know. He's very upwardly mobile. He doesn't care who he steps on to get to where he's going. He has this naked need for a father figure, for approval. You know, he gets Peggy Olson pregnant and doesn't know or care. And yet, you know, again, we sort of end up rooting for him because we're shown these other aspects of his personality that show him to have a lot of depth and a lot of, you know, like a lot of the characters on the show, he's trapped in the social milieu, which he can't really get out of. And I think the show is very skillful at showing how if they were simply in a different social environment, these characters might not be so unpleasant, you know, because they would be given so many more options and, you know, so many different things would be expected of them, you know, they wouldn't be quite so straitjacketed by their roles.
Pete has a lot of similarities with Don in terms of the fact that he's in a relationship with a woman he's married to because that's what's expected. And his wife, Trudy, is, you know, someone who comes from a very wealthy family and who is obsessed with having kids of her own, which is something that Pete really doesn't care to be involved with.
Kind of vocalizes that at one point. He says, like, why do we have to have children? You know, is it just because that's what we're supposed to do? And, you know, she's shocked by that idea, you know, and she says, well, yes, of course. You know, that's exactly why. It's what we're supposed to do, you know, and she doesn't even understand his objection. You know, well, there are things you're supposed to do, and you just do them, you know, you don't question them.
And also, there's near the end of season two, Sterling Cooper is going to be sold to this British conglomerate. And along with the sale, the person who is engineering the sale, whose name is Duck Phillips, he's going to be made president. And then, you know, really give Don Draper kind of the shaft and make him a second-class citizen in his own company. And Pete is privy to this information because Duck goes to him and says, I want you to have my job. You're going to be the new head of accounts. And then Pete takes that information and goes to Don and gives him the heads up as far as what's going on. Why do you think that happens?
You know, that's a very interesting question. It's, you know, I just finished rewatching season two because the DVD just came out, and you know, I'm prepping for the beginning of season three, and it's very hard to tell because Pete keeps it very close to the vest in those scenes. You know, we had previously seen, I think it's either the first or the second episode of season two, where Pete's father dies in a plane crash, and you know, he's not really close to the rest of his family, so he sort of goes to his coworkers. He goes to Duck Phillips and to Don Draper to see basically how he should react and what he should do. And he ends up bonding with Duck Phillips, not because, you know, Duck really cares that much about Pete, but he shows these sort of fatherly intentions. You know, he's sort of, you know, he's like, well, look, you're part of our family here, and, you know, we want you to be okay. And he sort of expresses this fatherly affectation, whereas Don is just like, well, go home and take care of it, you know, deal with your stuff. And sort of drawn to Duck because of that. And yet, you know, when the time comes at the end of the series, or at the end of the second season, rather, you know, as you say, he really, you know, he has the opportunity to get on board with Duck Phillips and screw Don Draper, and yet he does the opposite. And it's hard to tell why. It may be because he's astute enough to know that Duck is going to squib his play, which is what happens. You know, it turns out that Duck has overestimated his power and ends up sort of getting screwed himself as the deal closes. He may have known that Don didn't have a contract, which would make a big difference in the business world, and he was just making a calculated business decision to get on Don Draper's side. Or it could be that he just genuinely has an affection towards Don, because it's always seemed like in the show that even as he's, I mean, you know, of course in season one, he tried to get Don fired himself. You know, he found out about this his other identity as Dick Whitman and tried to use it to get Don fired. And of course, that it turned out that nobody really cared. So, you know, he also blew his play. But, you know, even when that was going on, he's always sort of seemed to want Don's approval, you know, and that may be because he sort of sees Don as the kind of person he'd like to be at some point. And that, you know, by throwing in his lot with Don at the end of season two, he's attempting to solidify their relationship. But they really didn't tip it very much, and I think that may be because there's more that's going to come out of that relationship as season three progresses, and they just didn't want to give too much away.
Well, just prior to that, that's when Don had left for California, and he had basically abandoned Pete, right, in advance of these very important meetings with some potential clients. And Pete never ratted Don out about that. He didn't say anything. Don took 3 weeks to come back, but you know, there are no APBs put out for him. And while he originally questioned about Don about that, you know, Don fed him the line that, well, you know, I left you out there because, I mean, of course it's a lie, but he's saying that he left him out there because he felt that he was responsible enough and capable enough to get the job done.
Right, right. And, you know, I think it's pretty clear that Don didn't believe that, but Pete might have believed it, so...
And then also I think that, you know, on some level, what you mentioned before I think is very accurate, in that Pete knows that Duck's not going to be a great leader of the company and that it's in much better hands with a guy like Don at the helm than it is with Duck Phillips.
Mm-hmm.
My name is Kevin Fulham, and you're listening to Under Surveillance on WLUW, and we've been talking all about the television drama Mad Men, which is about to begin its third season on AMC. Mad Men is a critically acclaimed show about the Sterling Cooper Advertising Agency, which is set against the backdrop of early 1960s America. It's a vehicle for commentary on everything from gender roles in the workplace to the illusion of personal identity, both of which we've talked at great length about. Leonard, before we close, any other commentary on the advertising industry you'd like to add?
Well, there's this book called Advertising the American Dream, and it was written by, it's an academic book, so I'm assuming it was written by a professor of business or advertising or something, but it's really an interesting book because it throws light on the fact that there was this very big quantum shift in advertising between the late 1800s, early 1900s, like turn of the century, and the 1920s. And before that, you know, in the 19th century and the 1900s and part of the teens, advertising had mostly been what people called rational at the time. In other words, it was mostly text. There was very little illustration or graphics. When there was an illustration, it was usually just a straightforward, realistic photograph or drawing of the product. And the advertising text was, buy this product because here is what it will do. Here's its function. Like if it's a physical object, it's the best of its kind. If it's a medicine, it will give you this particular effect. You know, it was all very straightforward. It's like, if you want this particular thing to happen, buy this product and it will cause that thing to happen. You know, or if you need a hammer, we make really good hammers, you know. And that was basically all there was to advertising. And in the teens and 20s, it started to become very irrational. It was more like, you know, if you buy our product, it will expose you to this kind of lifestyle, or, you know, it will have this effect on your life, or if you want to be this kind of person that we're portraying in this ad, then buy our product and it will allow you to be that kind of person. And that's the way advertising has been ever since. You know, you almost never hear ads that are selling what the product is. They're selling what experience you will have if you buy the product, or what kind of person you will be if you become part of the people who buy that product. And so, you know, I mean, that's what Mad Men is so good at, is portraying that Don Draper's genius is that Don Draper doesn't care what the product is. He says it over and over again. He says, we're not selling the product, we're selling the experience of the product, you know. When he comes up with his advertisement for airlines, he says, it doesn't matter where the airline is going, it's about the journey, it's about the you being the kind of person who can take a pleasure trip, you know. And, you know, you even see this in his protege, Peggy, when she gets this, towards the end of season two, she gets this big Popsicle account. And she says, you know, it's not about advertising popsicles. It's about the, you know, advertising the ritual of eating a popsicle, you know, because it's tradition. You know, you have this sort of little ritual of breaking it in half and sharing it with your relative or whatever. You know, that's something that people have done for generations, and that's what we're selling. And, you know, that's the way advertising has been since this big leap that took place in the teens, is that it stopped being about selling what the product is or what the product does. It's been about selling the world in which the product exists, you know, and the lifestyle that the product represents. And that's been the dominant paradigm for, you know, 80 years now, you know, or more. And you watch any commercial, you know, whether it's for a car or a soda or, you know, a trip someplace or anything, and they almost never talk about what the product actually does, you know, or what it actually is. Everybody knows what it is. You know, nobody needs to be told what Coca-Cola is. What they are doing in Coca-Cola advertising is selling the lifestyle that supposedly goes along with drinking Coca-Cola. You know, and when I used to be in the natural foods industry, we would always go to these big trade shows, and Coca-Cola and Pepsi-Cola would always be there. And they would spend millions of dollars building these pavilions and giving away free Coke or free Pepsi or whatever. And I always wondered, why are they even spending money on advertising? I mean, you can't go anywhere in the world, literally, and not find Coca-Cola. You know, everybody in the world knows what Coca-Cola is. Everybody knows what it tastes like. Everybody knows what its function is. Why does Coca-Cola even need to advertise? It's an advertising-proof product. People are just going to buy it because they want Coke, you know. You can go to any store in America, even if it's not a food store. You can go to, like, a pet shop or a garage, and there's a Coke machine there. That's how prevalent it is in our society, and yet they still spend millions of dollars on advertising every year. And it's because advertising isn't really about informing people about your product. It's about maintaining this sort of cultural milieu in which your product plays a big part. And, you know, I think Mad Men is very skillful at getting to that idea, and that's why it portrays Don Draper as being such a genius, because he gets that. You know, he gets that it doesn't matter what the product is or how many people have heard of it or whatever. It matters what image the product is trying to create.
Yeah, I think you see that very much in terms of the coffee campaign also as well. So you see, that's one of the reasons that they bring in these two young kids to work at Sterling Cooper. It's because young people aren't drinking coffee, which is, of course, very ironic because that's all young people drink today. but back then, hey, you know, kids, they just want Pepsi and Coke, and they put it in their cereal, and they don't drink coffee. So they come up with this jingle. It's got this Calypso-type theme. Very, you know, Jamaican, Caribbean. And just this song about coffee. It doesn't really talk anything about what it's like, but it's all about that image that it's trying to impart.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there was somebody was quoted in that Thomas Frank book saying that, like, in an ideal commercial, they don't even need to show you what the product is. They could not show the product, you know, and you would still want it afterwards, because it's just like, well, whatever it is that commercial did, it made me want that thing, even though I don't know what it is. You know?
At what point, then, did celebrity endorsements become key? I mean, you see that with the Mad Men era with the guys like Jimmy Barrett, who was pushing, I think it was Utz Chips or Utz Snacks.
Mm-hmm. Right around that same time, right around the 19-teens, before that, the only kind of endorsements you would see would be from professionals. Like, occasionally, you would hear, like, a doctor, you know, would say, well, you should buy this particular kind of patent medicine or this kind of hygiene product or whatever. Or, you know, what you saw in the early days of cereal is almost all the early breakfast cereals and the Post Company and the Kellogg's Company, they were not started to sell junky sugar cereal to little kids. they were originally, you know, the guys who founded those companies, C.W. Post and I think his name was Arthur Kellogg, they were doctors, and they were trying to sell what they considered health food. And so all of their advertisement was very rational. It was like, well, you know, if you buy this particular product, it has all these various nutritional qualities, and, you know, this is what we, they both ran sanitariums in Michigan. That was their claim to fame. And Battle Creek, Michigan, where those cereals were manufactured, was originally known because all these doctors had sanitariums there. And so they said, you know, if you want to eat like the people who come to my sanitarium and be very healthy, then you should eat, you know, Post Toasties or, you know, cornflakes or whatever. And graham crackers were also started in that city in Battle Creek. The guy who invented them, Dr. Graham, intended them to suppress female masturbation. But yeah, so, you know, before that, you know, it was all just doctors, or like occasionally they'd hire a professional architect to say buy these tools or whatever. And then in the 1900s and the 19-teens, you started seeing, like, well, Charles Lindbergh did all kinds of celebrity advertisements, and lots of famous athletes, you know, Babe Ruth was kind of famous for endorsing everything that came down the pike, and, you know, Ty Cobb was a big endorser of Coca-Cola. Of course, he also owned a huge amount of stock in the company, which is how he got rich. But, you know, he was also a celebrity endorser because he was a famous baseball player. And part of that is because, you know, that was the time at which we were developing a national media, you know, and where the idea of celebrities was becoming, you know, the idea that there was a single person that everybody in the country had heard of was first starting to take stock, was in the 19-teens and 20s. It's generally the same point. It's a very, I wish I could remember the name of the guy who wrote the book, but it's a very interesting study of how advertising really made this very profound change in the 19-teens. And Tom Frank talks about that a little bit in his Conquest of Cool book as well.
You've been listening to Under Surveillance on WLEW, and my name is Kevin Fulham. I've been joined by pop culture critic Leonard Pierce, who has written about film and music for numerous national publications. He also currently contributes to the Onion's AV Club. And anything else that you're working on right now, Leonard?
Well, I'm working on a number of projects right now. I have the AV Club has a book coming out in a few months of inventories that we've done over the years. And I'm still working for various local and regional publications, doing music, television, and film reviews, and whatever else comes my way.
And you can check out information on Leonard's writing at ludikid.com. That's ludickid.com. And thanks so much for joining me back on the show, Leonard. It's always a pleasure. For Leonard Pierce, my name is Kevin Fulham, and you've been listening to Under Surveillance on WLEW. And for more information or to listen to archived shows, visit www.undersurveillance.org. That's www.undersurveillance.org.